What was Binky Beaumont like? Do you have particular memories of
him? He's a very nice man, yeah. One time, we had a van, the firm had a van to do run-around jobs, and he said, could you come with me to London Airport? We've got to meet Marlene Dietrich. So I was driving the van, and we got there, and he was very ordinary. He'd never dressed to excess. He just had a plain overcoat on, and we waiting there for Marlene, and she came out, and she had a lot of luggage, big wardrobe trunks, and so we loaded these on the van. I had a chap with me, and we went to the hotel in Park Lane, and we took all these boxes up, these great big trunks up to her room. The lift only went to a certain floor, and she had the penthouse suite, so we had to carry the trunks up to the other thing. And when we got up there, she said, "I don't want those here, I want those at the theatre." So we had to carry the blessed trunks all the way down again, take them to the Queen's Theatre.
Did she say it with that lack of charm as well?
Oh, yes. From behind, she looked like a schoolgirl until she turned round, and then you realise how old she was.
Yeah.
But she was very nice about it all.
Yeah. So that was a bit later on, but you in the 60s, some of the things that stand out, I suppose, were, well, unless you want to go through them, but particularly I felt Lady McWyndham Is a Fan, which had a set by Cecil Beaton, 1966.
That must have been
quite interesting.
That was at the Phoenix, I think.
Yeah.
Lady McWyndham Is a Fan.
Was Cecil Beaton a kind of interesting character? Did you have to deal with him as the set designer?
I didn't have much to do with him. No, I didn't see him. You didn't see these designers much. They, if they came in, they didn't sort of worry about you. They saw the set, and if it pleased them, they were off again.
Yeah. That production was followed in your CV by There's a Girl in My Soup at the Globe, which was really
a
phenomenon, because it was became the longest running comedy in the West End. Terence Frisby, pretty much unknown, suddenly
the most
lucrative
kept
of playwrights.
Transferring, yeah.
Did that involve a big job for you, that show? I don't know, is that?
No, it was a standing set. It was quite easy.
Yeah.
And some of the standing sets are easy, you see. It's the musicals where you get all the work, where you get so many scenes.
I mean, There's a Girl in My Soup, I noticed, starred not only Donald Sinden and John Pertwee, but Barbara Ferris, who was also in Edward Bond Saved in 1965. So really sort of quite a change in the air, I suppose.
Yeah. Did very well, Girl in My Soup. I think it transferred from here, I think I remember, to the Apollo. Then it went from the Apollo somewhere to the Queen's, probably. And then from the Queen's, I don't know where, I think it went,
Garrick?
Maybe the Comedy, was it?
Was it the Garrick?
Or the Garrick. It never stopped transferring. Mm. It ran and ran and ran.
Huge farce. And then you have, it's interesting actually, sometimes it's interesting the plays that people have completely forgotten. For example, a bit later on, 1969, you work on this play, Battle of the Shrivings, which is actually a kind of forgotten Peter Shaffer play.
Oh yeah, Battle of the Shrivings, yes. That was, what was his name?
That was Peter Shaffer.
Yeah, but I think Peter Hall directed that.
Ah, okay.
From the National, I think Peter Hall did that, and that opened at Brighton, Battle of the Shrivings, and that was a peculiar set. It was all covered in cork, and it was difficult to handle. You'd pick it up, this scenery, and you'd have a handful of cork. And it was all covered in that, but that was a successful show. Where did that go into? I think that went into the Lyric, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's what it says here.
Battle of the Shrivings, yeah.
And prior to that, you'd done at Drury Lane Hello Dolly, so production carpenter for that
massive
show.
Yeah, Hello Dolly.
Um, another big. I mean, do you like Drury Lane? Was it? Did you kind of, in terms of the theatres you've worked at, did you have favourites? Or
I quite like Drury Lane. Yes. At one time, I worked in the prop shop there. They had a chap called Boxall. I think his name was Jack Boxall, and we had a roaring fire going backstage there, and we used to make paper mache heads for King and I that was coming on, and this fire was to dry them out, and we'd put all these heads round, because the girls in King and I used to go on with these big paper mache heads, so all day long we were making these in the thing. And then we were, after that, we were making grass skirts for South Pacific. And who should walk in one day and said, hello, Rodgers and Hammerstein. Walked in and shook hands with us all and thanked us for all our hard work. That was a very big show.
Yes. Yeah, Sean Connery.
He was on tour with us.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Sean Connery, yes. And
he was a chorus boy.
Yeah, he was in the chorus. Now, the funny thing is, the company manager who was with it, who is still alive and lives in Brighton, I said to him one day, because I used to go and see him once in a while, I said, how much was Sean Connery getting in those days? Because you paid the wages. He said, £12 a week. Hmm. And I said, how much was I getting? He said, 13. So I was quite...
He was already in the money.
Yeah. But I thought I was earning more than him. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a lovely little kind of plethora of shows. End of the 60s, early 70s. But I suppose the one that sticks out again is aside from maybe The Magistrate, which starred Alistair Sim at the Cambridge Theatre, which comes every generation, I think, has a revival of The Magistrate. But Godspell arrives at the Roundhouse.
Godspell,
1972,
under the Roundhouse.
With incredible, you know, David Essex.
Yes.
Jeremy Irons, 1972. I mean,
yes.
What was that like? Because you worked at the Roundhouse with that show first.
Yeah, opened at the Roundhouse, then we went on tour. And it wasn't too bad. I remember we had two boat trucks either side with musicians on them, I think. So a simple set, really. So that was no trouble.
I mean, was it a kind of more rough and tumble kind of environment back in the 60s and 70s?
It was very peaceful.
Yeah.
Very peaceful. There were lots of girls on the game then.
Yeah.
In these roundabouts, you know, and you could almost time them. You know, they'd get a customer and you'd say, now, just let's see how long she takes.
Yeah.
And in about 20 minutes, she'd be back walking up and down the street.
Yeah.
And so you knew they were quite busy. But what they used to do, they used to stop one of the punters and say, now, I've got my key here. I live just up there.
Yeah.
Go up there and wait for me, and I'll be up in 10 minutes, you see. And the bloke would take the key up and try it in the door, and of course it wouldn't fit. And she didn't turn up at all. And she'd already got his money, you see.
Yeah. So was that kind of quite, I mean, when they cleaned up Soho a bit, did you feel that something kind of died a bit?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It wasn't quite as colourful.
No, the girls sort of disappeared overnight. There was the Wolfenden report, I think, in those days, where they looked into all this and somehow they got the poor girls off the street.
And in general, were there ever kind of dodgy types, gangster types, criminals, whatever, trying to get muscle in on theatre, or was it a little haven in a way? It wasn't something you had to deal with?
There was a girl in the street just upstairs. And she'd say to me, she'd open the window and she'd shout down, she'd see me on the corner talking to someone, oh, can you come up? I've got a little job for you. And so I'd go up and take my tool bag up the stairs. She was on about the third floor. And it was like a doctor's waiting room. There were all these characters waiting to see her.
Mm.
She used to get policemen, priests, all sorts. And so she rang me up on the, she called me up on a matinee day. And so I went up there and she said, can you change the lock? Someone broke it last night. So I put a new Yale lock on and it was quite dark in the space. And I said, well, I can't be long. I said, I've got matinee at 2:30. So I'm working away. And in the room where she performed, she had a two-way mirror. And people used to come up and look through the mirror and pay her, of course, for the privilege. And so I changed the lock and did things like that.
Mm.
I think some weeks she took more money than the theatre.
And did you have any rivals? I mean, was anyone after your job, as it were? Or were you kind of, once you were here,
no,
you were secure?
So I think the difficulty was, I used to get lots of jobs. People would ring me up and say, oh, we've got a load up on Friday. We've got a show going there. Can you come and load us up? And I would go along with a gang of men to put the show, to load it onto the lorry. And it was difficult not to miss out people. If you miss them out, they used to get a bit angry. They thought you were showing favoritism. And so, yeah, so I got quite a name for sort of putting the right people on and not putting others on.
Mm.
But you couldn't do any other thing, you see. You couldn't give them jobs if there weren't any.
Yeah, yeah.
So they used to say I was like the mafia and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. How many people do you think would you actually have ended up sort of indirectly or directly employing? And I mean, in a sort of average production?
Dozens
yeah.
of people. Yeah, but I had, if I had a big fit-up coming on, I had all my favourites, you see. You knew who were good, knew who were bad, and because you put on the good blokes, you see.
Mm.
And in return, they would put you on if they had a show.
Mm.
It's like a village, really.
Yeah.
Everybody
mm.
knew everybody else.
And you'd presumably you'd know which shows were dying
oh,
faster
yeah.
than even the journalists would.
Yeah,
you'd hear on the grapevine.
But I used to do load-ups and get-outs and that's how it worked in those days. And there wasn't, you could earn a lot of money tax-free. Now it's all taxed. But you could go and do a get-out for someone and
mm.
it would be £20,
mm.
no tax-free. They would just pay you, you see.
Yeah.
So that was the beauty of it. And then, of course, they got very strict and every penny had to be taxed. Like matinees, you could employ
mm.
men on a matinee and just pay them the rate
mm.
without worrying about tax. They were just part-time workers, you see.
Yeah.
But now it's all taxed. You can't pay a penny without.
So it's kind of increased the costs quite a lot.
Yeah,
for the shows,
of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just to, I'm just going to quickly scamper across the list from the '70s because there's a lot in there.
Yeah.
And then we start seeing the name Michael Codron, who you worked
oh,
for.
Oh, Michael Codron.
On
yeah.
My Fat Friend at the Globe.
Mm.
And
Man
then a bit later,
the
collaborators at the Duchess, and again further on,
yeah.
Norman Conquest at the Globe,
mm.
which is obviously the big Alan Ayckbourn hit. With Tom Courtney as Norman in that premiere.
Yeah.
What's your first impressions of Michael Codron? Was he always going to be a big
oh,
name in the producing world?
He was a nice man. Funnily enough, I got invited to a garden party at Buckingham Palace, and I couldn't think, why have they picked me to go? And I discovered later, in years later, they. Peter Baldwin, there was a man called
mm.
Peter Baldwin who used to put on shows and I did quite a lot for him and he must have put my name forward because I got invited to Buckingham Palace Garden Party and they were all there with all the ladies had bought new hats and there were field marshals and archbishops and all sorts of people at this Buckingham Palace Garden Party. And of course, I didn't know any of them. And then who should come walking down the path who I recognised? Michael Codron. So I said, oh, hello. And so we had a nice chat. And he was telling me, Michael Connelly, he said, when you put a show on, he said, I have no trouble finding actors or actresses. He said, I just ring up the agents and I can get a leading man or a leading lady. He said, but the problem is when I want a carpenter to go on tour, he said, they don't have agents.
Mm.
He said, and it's very difficult to get somebody reliable to put on the show, to fit it up sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, I didn't know. Anyway, these are some of the shows I've got that I did for him. Michael Codron, 1990, Man of the Moment. Mm. Then 1990 again, Hidden Laughter.
Yeah.
Then another one, Private Lives, Michael Codron.
So Private Lives, that was a recent revival, was it? With
and that was 1990.
Yeah.
And then I've got.
Can we just stop at Man of the Moment? I know we're kind of going to the end of the trail a little bit, but there are such a great story, isn't there? Because Man of the Moment is the show that Alan Ayckbourn wrote about a thief, a criminal who turns into a kind of celebrity and involves a swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a kind of potentially
a
nightmare.
That was here.
Yeah.
Oh.
What were your memories of that production?
Oh,
that was unbelievable. They had this swimming pool right in the prompt side of the stage, and it was full of water, of course. And this particular night, we had a relief fireman on. And it was the fireman's duty to drop the iron curtain in the interval. Well, funnily enough, in most theatres, there's a handle for the iron curtain and a handle for the sprinkler. Why they ever built them like that, but next door to each other, these two handles. Well, I saw this relief fireman coming along to drop the iron curtain. And I was the other side of the swimming pool, so I couldn't rush across to stop him. And I could see him going to pull the wrong handle. And I said, no, not that one. And he pulled it, and it was the sprinkler.
Mm.
So, of course, the sprinkler is right downstage, and it pours water onto the tabs, which are right next door to it, the curtain. So these curtains got soaked with water, and a pint of water weighs a pound. You could imagine these tabs came rushing down so quickly they snapped the wires, and the counterweight, which was on the other end, came crashing down into the prompt corner. There was all lumps of timber coming down, dust coming down. And so it was an absolute disaster. And
it went into the pool, the tabs, and stained it orange.
Yeah. And the people in the front row, of course, were getting soaked with water.
Mm.
So the company manager said, what are we going to do? I said, well, cancel. I said, what else can you do? There's no tab, there's no set, there's nothing. So
this unfolded mid-performance, just before the interval. And what did the fireman say at this point?
He didn't know. He said, anyway, it was too late for recriminations. And the next day, we had a lorry come along and take away these soaking wet curtains to some special firm that looked after it. And that was the story.
Yeah.
Did you have to get special? You had to rent curtains off some other theatre.
We had to borrow curtains from someone else.
Was it Duke of York or something?
Yeah.
So they only lost the one show.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, that's
the funny thing is, you'd think, well, after all that, it would all be over. I got a phone call about 3 weeks later from Cyril Griffiths, who was the engineer. He rang down. He said, can you get round to Drury Lane, get a gang of men as quickly as you can? He said, the fireman's pulled the sprinkler. They were having an understudy call at Drury Lane. So I rushed round there on the phone and got about half a dozen blokes. And the same thing had happened again.
Mm.
There were the tabs soaking wet, all laying on the stage.
Mm.
at Drury Lane, I mean, the weights there, the counterweights, weigh about 100 weight, you know.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so easy as...
Yeah, God, who'd have thought that a sprinkler system could create such havoc?
Yeah.
And then further on, Donkey's years, were you... Want to maybe talk about the cap, because at that point, 1976,
oh, the
Michael Frayn's played Donkey's Years, and Beerbohm the Theatre Cat is the only cat to have got a full page, front page on the stage.
Yeah, now I've got all about the cat.
How did the cat come to be here?
What's well, funnily enough, we had a fireman here called David.
Mm.
I forget something. And
Morris.
These firemen used to go to different theatres to do their duties because there was a shortage of them. And he went down to Her Majesty's and he saw this cat that was not very popular there. And so he brought him back here. His name was Beerbohm. He was named after Beerbohm Tree, the famous actor manager of Her Majesty's. And it was a lovely little cat. And I've got this book. When he died, he had an obituary in more or less every paper.
So there's a theatre legend, it says here. This is he made it into, as
oh,
you say,
yeah,
pretty much every newspaper had a Daily
yeah.
Mail, Exit Cat, Pursued
yeah.
by Tears, as the headline.
Yeah.
Quentin Letts, who's he? Quentin Letts, somebody called Quentin Letts. writing a column in Peterborough, the Mail. And then, yeah, a whole, as you say, a whole scrapbook.
Oh, yeah.
With people saying...
Japanese fans.
Goodbye and God bless to the cat.
They rang me from the head office.
This is a tabby cat, really rather adorable tabby cat.
Ordinary looking cat, but he was a little darling. And
Where did he actually live? Well, everywhere? Or was there a particular place?
Well, he was in the theatre, you see, and when we had a new show come in, he was a crafty little devil. He used to discover who liked cats and who didn't. So some of the actors and actresses took to him and he used to be waiting for them every night. And as soon as they went to their dressing room, he was in and they used to bring him little snacks and things. And he loved
prawns.
It. Prawns, he loved prawns, yeah.
So he lived like a king.
Yeah.
Must have got rather fat, did he? Didn't he? Or did he
no.
Was just,
no, he was
did he actually usefully serve any purpose? Did he get the mice that sometimes lurk in?
No, we never had any mice. We had Rentacule who used to put it. He'd have run away from a mouse, I think. But I used to come up and feed him on Christmas Day even.
Mm.
I felt sorry because he was so used to being amongst a lot of people, I thought, oh, he's going to wonder what's happened. All the theatre was dead. I used to come up on Christmas Day and feed him.
Your daughter came in when he was hit by a car.
Yeah.
And took care of him.
Yeah.
And he had a plaster cast.
Yeah, he had a plaster cast. We took him to
Blue Cross.
Yeah, Blue Cross.
Mm.
They put a plaster cast on him.
Mm. And did he used to steal little appearances on the stage as well? He used to come across.
He was always going on the stage and they used to say, your cat is on stage. I said, he's not my cat, he's the theatre cat. I just feed him.
Yeah.
And he went on with Hinge and Bracket. Do you remember Hinge and Bracket?
Yeah.
And they used to sing a song about a cat. And so after the first night when he went on, he just suddenly appeared and walked on the stage and brought the house down. And the next night they said, do you mind if we take your cat on stage? So I said, no, I don't mind. So they used to take him on with them then.
Yeah. And do you think he ever killed a moment? There was a high moment of drama and the cat suddenly wandered on and broke the spell.
Not really, no.
That didn't happen.
There was a show, what was that show where they...
Mitford.
The Mitford girls. And he used to sleep
on
the balcony.
Yeah, it was a spiral staircase.
And as soon as the lights came on and the music
he was
started,
at the top.
He put his head up above the thing and, of course, made his first appearance. And
fantastic.
We had another show here about Dr. Livingstone, where he discovered in the jungle.
That was a Harold Pinter.
And we had like a
director.
Mad Hut, that was the set.
Oh.
And the actors had to go on at one point.
Jeremy Irons.
And put mud on their faces.
Yeah.
So the stage manager had got a little tray with Fuller's Earth in it, which I used to put on. And
looked
then
very like a liturgy.
And then one morning, old Beerbohm, he thought this was a liturgy, and he was dropping his card into this Fuller's Earth. So however long that had gone on, I don't know.
Jeremy Irons
these actors,
came back and complained.
Yeah.
I think I've put cat poo on my face.
Yeah.
Well, it's just, it's...
yeah, it's funny the things that happen.
Recipe for success there. So a couple of, some interesting celebrity moments. Dame Edna, Housewives Superstar, 1976.
Yes.
Barry Humphries doing Dame Edna at the kind of height of Edna fever in a way, because nothing had really been quite seen like that, I suppose. Was that an experience?
Yes. It was an experience because
Joe and the Gladys.
She used to swing out.
Yeah.
And I attached the swing to these counterweight bar, you see. Well, in those days we had hemp lines, we didn't have counterweights. We had hemp lines which held the bar together, you see, and they rolled bars, and I was a bit wary when I was rigging it up, so I put extra lines on either side of where the pipe joined, you see, and this particular night this bar snapped. It was my night off, as it happened, and this bar snapped, but luckily instead of it crashing down, it just sort of gave him a jolt. And so he was swinging out over the orchestra pit, you see.
Hmm.
And all was saved, but it could have been nasty. He could have finished up with this bar on his head.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, dear.
I came in the next day and they told me all about it. I said, oh, well, good job I put the extra lines on it.
So did you deal with him as Barry Humphries or as in character as Dame Edna?
Oh, he would just used to come in the morning and have a chat with you. He was a very nice man.
Mm.
And we had a dressing room backstage full of gladioli.
Oh,
they used to be delivered. All the plants, he used to throw them out to the audience.
Yes, his gladies.
Gladioli.
So you also have Rowan Atkinson in review. I don't know.
Oh, he was very nice, yes.
Yeah.
We had him here. And he did terrific business. The place was booked, fully booked. And at one point, they got permission from the council to have 200 people standing at the back of the stalls because they couldn't seat them all.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was a very nice man. At first, we thought, oh, he's a bit standoffish. He doesn't talk to anybody, and he used to just come on and do his bit. And then after about 3 weeks, he stopped me one night and he said, oh, I'd like to explain and apologise. He said, he says, it's not like me to ignore everybody. He said, but I've been so busy remembering my lines and my bits. So he said, please, you know, nice to meet you and everything. Shook hands and he was delightful.
I think the major shows that we probably do need to talk about quickly, if we can.
Yeah, yeah.
Firstly, well, Amadeus, massive success with Simon Callow and Paul Scofield and Felicity Kendall, and that was in 1982.
Was funny, yeah.
Then we also have, to my mind anyway, Phantom of the Opera, which you look after, 1986.
Oh, yes, Phantom of the Opera.
Big,
yeah.
Almost decade-defining show that was.
Yeah.
And then I suppose perhaps you can talk about those two shows, but anything else that strikes you, in a way, at what point you decided to stop? I think there's too many questions in that, but it's just what those big shows reach their kind of peak with Phantom of the Opera, don't they? I mean, that doesn't get much bigger.
No.
What was your kind of experience of that?
Oh, Phantom of the Opera. Yeah. Well, I was great friends with the man who made the scenery for that. There was a man called Terry Murphy, who did. Made all the scenery for all the big shows. And of course the people who make the show come in and fit it up to make sure everything works, which they've been paid for. Anyway, he rang me up about 3 weeks before the show was due to open at Her Majesty's and said, can you get some men and go down and work at night? He said, because they're rehearsing on stage in the day and we can't do the alterations. And he said, I'm busy with other shows. So I said, yes, all right. So I got together about six chaps and we used to go down there at night and do all the jobs that had to be done. In the stage, they had lots of little trapdoors where the lights came up. And they had a chandelier that crashed in and had to be fixed every night. And different alterations. So I was working here, so I used to get these men and we'd go down and we'd work all night doing all these jobs. And then we had to be back, of course, to our own theatres in the morning. And that's how it worked out. But of course, we didn't mind. We were on double time, you see. And so we could earn a little bit extra. And that's how it happened. Mm. And that was Terry Murphy, who was a lovely man. That's how we come to do Phantom of the Opera. The last show here was Vanessa Redgrave in the thing. She was very kind. She gave me a poster and got all the company to sign it.
Mm.
And I've still got the time, I can't remember. It was a Russian thing, something to do with Russia.
Mm.
I would advise any young person to always be on time, always be very reliable. Because if people can rely on you, they will employ you again and again. So I never let anybody down. If I said I'd be there at 9 o'clock, I'd be there by hook or by crook, and I'd be there and I'd do the job, load up or unload, whatever it was.
Did you have many holidays? It doesn't sound like you did.
Only when I retired.
Yeah, it was full on from 20s to
60s. Yeah, I didn't have many holidays when I was on tour, because every week you were going to somewhere different. You could have a nice time if you wanted to in the afternoons.
Yeah.
You work mornings and evenings, you see. Yes, no.
And I can't say what is your worst experience, but I suppose some of those turnarounds and the taking the set apart and then working till late in the night, I mean, sometimes it must, and if the weather was bad or something, it must have been quite
yeah,
tough going.
Yeah, it could be damned awful, yeah.
Yeah.
And long hours, very long hours. You'd have to work all day and all night and think nothing of. No, I got used to it. And the funny thing was, when I retired, I couldn't sleep. And I suppose it was because I'd got used to doing so many all-nighters.
Yeah.
I finished up at Guy's Hospital, where in there they've got a special department for people who can't sleep. It didn't cure me at all. I still couldn't sleep, so I managed to persuade my doctor to give me sleeping pills, and I've been on them ever since.
But the whole clock, your whole body clock is...
I just couldn't sleep.
Theatre. Yeah.
No, and I used to think, oh, well, I'll drink some wine, or I'll drink this. Something will make me go to sleep, and none of it worked.
Yeah. You had to take one production alone onto a desert island of the one show of all the shows that you've done. What would it be, do you think?
I think Irma La Douce, I think, would be my favourite show. And, well, there's so many.
Why would it be that? Why would it be that one in particular, do you think?
Well, it was, it used to stop, they used to bring the house down every night, this particular thing. And you felt you'd achieved something. And it was a very tricky show, Irma La Douce.
Well, because you'd made so many people happy.
Strikes.
Yeah.
And it was hard work, probably one of the hardest shows I've done, but the one I appreciated the most. West Side Story was a nice show.
Yeah.
Phantom of the Opera was very good. They were all good, but there's so many. I mean, when I look at the list, I can't believe I did all these shows. You know, there's foolscap pages of them. and the I mean, musicals alone, South Pacific, King and I, Homer Le Douce, West Side Story, My Fair Lady, Pajama Game, Call Me Madam, Hello Dolly, No No Nanette, Thomas and the King, Godspell, Gigi, Gypsy.
I know.
It's a hell of a lot of shows.
Kind of musical lover's paradise there. I mean, you've opened a door really onto a world that most people don't really know very much about. I mean, do you feel that maybe the backstage world and the stage management world and the kind of basically the infrastructure, do they get that? Do they get enough praise? Or
I don't think so. As I say, it's a very upstairs, downstairs show.
Yeah.
I mean, on an opening night, you've worked night and day to put the show on, and on the opening night, all the actors and actresses get flowers and bottles of champagne sent to them, and they don't seem to remember
the crew
who've gone through all this night and day. Funny old world.
It's a funny world. All the world's a stage, but particularly all the world of the globe only really depends on the stage crew. So I think, thank you so much, Tony Ramsay. It's been a pleasure, and I wish you all the best for your 90th.